conversation with you. Well, good morning. My name is Sissy. I'm one of the pastors here, and it's so good to be with you this morning. We are in the middle of a series that we've entitled Not Forgotten, where we've been walking through the story of the book of Ruth. And last week, Barry took us through chapter one. So if you weren't here, if you missed it, I'd really encourage you to jump onto the podcast or get online to listen to that message. But let me try to get us up to speed. In chapter one, we learned that this was a dark time in Israel's history. There's famine in the land, and we're introduced to a few characters: Elimelech, an Israelite, his wife Naomi, and their two sons. And because of this famine, they move to Moab. And over the course of time, Elimelech dies, and the two sons go on to marry Moabite women, Orpah and Ruth, who struggle with infertility. And then the two sons die, leaving Naomi a widow, no husband, and no sons. And in a patriarchal culture like this one, that's the equivalent of a death sentence. No one to care for her, no one to provide for her. And so at the end of chapter one, we find Naomi telling her daughters-in-law to go back to their homes, their families, and their gods. She has nothing left to offer them. Now, Orpah makes the rational choice, and she returns home to her family, but not Ruth. Ruth pledges her loyalty and love to Naomi and to Naomi's God, and she returns with her to Bethlehem. That's where we left off last week at the end of chapter one, and this morning we're going to walk through some more of the story by taking a look at chapter two. Life wasn't fair to Ruth and Naomi. And life isn't fair to a lot of people today. There are things that take place in our world that just don't make sense to me. Things that break my heart, that I know break the heart of God. Thousands of people are being detained at our borders, held in facilities. Children often separated from their parents, men and women living under inhumane conditions. And no matter where you stand politically, this has nothing to do with my political ideology, no matter where you stand politically, that ought to deeply trouble us. That ought to bother us. Because every single one of them was made in the image of God with immense dignity, matchless worth. Consider something a little closer to home. Consider the plight of the homeless in our community. For the second year in a row, the number of homeless people in Dallas and Collin counties has increased. It actually went up 9% from last year. The total homeless population in these counties now stands at 4,538. 4,538 people living on the streets. Every single one of them made in the image of God with immense dignity, matchless worth. Let me give you one more example. Think about at-risk youth, students who are at risk for dropping out of school for so many factors such as homelessness, a limited proficiency in English, unstable home lives, or because they're in and out of foster care, and so many other reasons. 71% of students in Irving ISD are considered at risk. 71%. That's nearly 20 points above the statewide average. Friends, this is where we live. This is our community. Education empowers. Education can change the trajectory of a young person's life. Do they not deserve a chance? Young people made in the image of God with immense dignity, matchless worth. And what ends up happening to me is I hear about all of this and I begin to wonder, what can I do? What am I supposed to do? Because all of it seems very intimidating, hard, and can I be honest? Uncomfortable. I don't know what to do. I don't know what to say. And so I begin to wonder, can I even make a difference? And I don't think I'm the only one. I think you hear about migrants and homeless, at-risk youth, sexually trafficked women and children, and we could keep going, can't we? I think you hear about all of that, and you begin to wonder, what can I do? What am I supposed to do? Can I even make a difference? Well, this morning, I want to look at the answers to those questions by looking at this scene in Ruth 2, and here's what I want to show us. The providential love of God moves us to action. The providential love of God moves us to action. And so what I want to do is to walk through this scene and to share with you a truth about God and two observations about how that truth impacts the characters in the story. A truth about God and two observations about how that truth impacts the characters in the story. And then I'll close with an application for all of us. Make sense? Okay, but before we jump into Ruth 2, I've got a disclaimer of sorts to make. You see, often when you hear the story of Ruth taught, it's told to us as some sort of romantic love story. And while there are elements of a relationship that will come into play later in the story, it's not just a romantic love story. It's so much more than that. See, I think the reason we make it out to be that is because we're uncomfortable with what God is actually calling us to in this story. This is a story of men and women partnering together for the kingdom of God. This is a story of courage and faith and God's providential love for his people who are called to live out that love in their everyday, ordinary lives. This is the story of Ruth. Ready to jump into Ruth 2? All right, let's go. We're going to actually pick it up at the end of chapter 1, Ruth 1:22. So Naomi returned from Moab, accompanied by Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, arriving in Bethlehem as the barley harvest was beginning. Now Naomi had a relative on her husband's side, a man of standing from the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. Ruth and Naomi arrive in Bethlehem, and right away we're introduced to a new character, Boaz. And here's what we know about him. He is Naomi's husband, Elimelech's relative. He's a man of substance, of power, a man of standing in the community. Now, somewhere along the way, we've also made him out to be a handsome, eligible bachelor, but the text does not support that. Now, what the narrator really wants us to know and to understand is that Boaz is a man of exceptional character. He's a man of valor. Picking up at verse 2. And Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, "Let me go to the fields and pick up the leftover grain behind anyone in whose eyes I find favor." And Naomi said to her, "Go ahead, my daughter." And so she went out, entered a field, and began to glean behind the harvesters. As it turned out, she was working in a field belonging to Boaz, who was from the clan of Elimelech. Just then, Boaz arrived from Bethlehem and greeted the harvesters. "The Lord be with you. The Lord bless you," they answered. And Boaz asked the overseer of his harvesters, "Who does that young woman belong to?" And the overseer replied, "She is the Moabite who came back from Moab with Naomi." Naomi and Ruth are hurting. They've suffered and experienced great loss. At times like this, it's understandable that these women would be despondent. But Ruth had made a vow to Naomi back in chapter 1. She had pledged her loyalty to Naomi and to her God. And so she thinks of Naomi, and she will do whatever it takes to care for her mother-in-law. She does the next right thing. She asks to go out and to get some food for them by gleaning in the fields. Now, the law required care for the foreigner, the orphan, and the widow. by stating that harvesters would deliberately leave the grain in the corners of their field for the poor, and that they wouldn't go back to gather ears of grain that they had dropped. As a Moabite and as a widow, Ruth would have been permitted to glean in these fields. But during this time, the Israelites didn't really follow the law. And so often, the right to glean was denied to the poor. And so Naomi tells Ruth to go. After all, they had to survive. Who knows how long it's been since they've eaten. And so Ruth sets out to glean. And then in verse 3, the writer adds this comment. He says, as it turns out, she was working in a field belonging to Boaz. As it turns out. That little phrase is loaded with irony and a whole lot of theology. The writer is grabbing us by the collar and he's screaming at us, do you see God at work here? Do you see him? This isn't chance. It isn't fate. It isn't coincidence. This is God at work in the lives of his people. Not only does Ruth end up in Boaz's field, but at just the right time, Boaz shows up. And so he asks, who's this woman? And he finds out that it's Ruth. Now, when we read that, often we think it's some kind of love at first sight moment, that Boaz spots Ruth and immediately he's checking her out for a prospective bride. But given the cultural context and what we know about Boaz as this man of integrity, that's highly unlikely. Marriage in this culture was a strategic alliance between two families. It was an opportunity to strengthen political and social ties and to improve your standing in the community. Who you married mattered. What mattered even more was what family your potential mate belonged to. Ruth isn't the type of girl that Boaz would pick for a bride. She's a gleaner, and that's lower than a field hand. She's a foreigner, a Moabite. Moabites were pagan worshipers. The nation of Moab were descendants of Abraham's nephew Lot, and they had a sordid history. They were one of Israel's greatest enemies. Ruth is an outsider. And not only that, she has a history of infertility. And in this culture, bearing children was incredibly important. She's no match for Boaz. He would lose his standing in the community. He would be disregarding his responsibilities to his family if he was ever interested in a woman like Ruth. The reason why Boaz notices Ruth is because she's an unfamiliar face among his regular gleaners. He just wants to know, who is she? What family does she belong to? Whose servant is she? But then his foreman tells him about an earlier conversation that he had with Ruth. Verse 7, she said, please let me glean and gather among the sheaves behind the harvesters. She came into the field and has remained here from morning till now, except for a short rest in the shelter. Now, typically, when harvesting a field, the hired men would go first. They would cut the stalks of grain. They would lay it on the ground for the hired female workers who would then follow. And they would gather up the grain. They'd bundle it together so that it could be taken to the threshing floor where the raw kernels would be separated from the useless husk. Gleaners came at the very end of this process. They were only allowed on the field after the male and female workers had finished and after all the bundled grain had been removed from the field. What Ruth is asking for goes against how things have always been done. See, she didn't just want to pick up leftover scraps for Naomi. That wouldn't be enough to feed them. And so instead, she comes up with a proposal to make sure that both she and Naomi would have enough to eat. She asked to glean and gather from among the sheaves. She asked to go where gleaners are not allowed to go and to work among the harvesters where there's plenty of freshly cut grain laying around, waiting to be gathered in bundles. Ruth takes a risk. She comes up with a bold plan so that she can ensure that she and Naomi did not starve. Back in chapter 1, Ruth made a commitment to Naomi and to Naomi's God. She said, don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go. And where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people and your God will be my God. And in that moment, on that road from Moab to Bethlehem, I think Ruth puts her trust in God. She pledges her loyalty to him alone. And while she might have been new in her faith, she understood that God's intention with the gleaning law was to make sure that the poor and the vulnerable would be cared for. Ruth risks being ostracized and even kicked out of the field by making a request like this. But she also knows that as a daughter of God, she had to live boldly. She had to fight for what's right, even when it seemed outrageous. Now, Boaz must have been shocked by this request, by this gleaner, this foreigner, this woman. He's the boss, after all. He should be calling the shots. Who is Ruth to ask this? And after all, how much did he really have to give to the gleaners? Wasn't it just the edges of the field that God had commanded him to leave for the poor? He had to make a living too. How much was he really required to give? Boaz could have easily dismissed Ruth. He could have sent her packing, but that's not what he does. Picking up at verse 8. So Boaz said to Ruth, "My daughter, listen to me. Don't go and glean in another field, and don't go away from here. Stay here with the women who work for me. Watch the field where the men are harvesting and follow along after the women. I've told the men not to lay a hand on you. And whenever you're thirsty, go and get a drink from the water jars the men have filled." At this, she bowed down with her face to the ground. She asked him, "Why have I found such favor in your eyes that you notice me, a foreigner?" Boaz replied, "I've been told all about what you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband. How you left your father and mother and your homeland and came to live with the people you did not know before. May the Lord repay you for what you've done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you've come to take refuge. May I continue to find favor in your eyes, my Lord," she said. "You have put me at ease by speaking kindly to your servant, though I do not have the standing of one of your servants." This is when you really start to see the kind of man that Boaz is. Because instead of getting offended, instead of getting angry, he's moved to act on Ruth's behalf. He hears her request, and it's almost like he's bent on making sure that she and Naomi will have more than enough. Ruth and Naomi aren't going to starve, not on Boaz's watch. And so Boaz tells Ruth to stay in the field with his female workers. He ensures that she'll be safe as she enters into a space where gleaners are not allowed and where likely the male workers would have mistreated her. Women faced real danger in this culture. And Boaz recognizes that. He does all he can to protect her. He then tells her to drink from the water jars when she's thirsty. In a culture where foreigners would draw water for Israelites, in a culture where women would draw water for men, Boaz's offer to Ruth to drink from the water that his men have drawn is astonishing. This doesn't happen. Ruth is so overwhelmed by Boaz's generosity. And Boaz isn't motivated by some kind of romantic interest in Ruth. He's motivated by his love for God and his respect and appreciation for Ruth's kindness and loyalty to Naomi. She's given everything up to come to Bethlehem to be with Naomi. And so he comforts her by blessing her and praying for her. "May the Lord repay you for what you've done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you've come to take refuge." What Boaz doesn't know is that he's part of how God will answer that very prayer. But Boaz is far from done. Verse 14. At mealtime, Boaz said to her, "Come over here, have some bread and dip it in the wine vinegar." And when she sat down with the harvesters, he offered her some roasted grain. She ate all she wanted and had some left over. Boaz invites Ruth to share a meal with him and with his workers. And then he goes on to serve her himself by giving her more food than she could possibly even eat. In the ancient Near East culture, meals meant a whole lot more than they do to us today. Meals were the highest expression of hospitality. Boaz invites Ruth, an outsider, to become an insider. Here is Ruth, a gleaner, eating with the hired workers. Here is Ruth, a Moabite, partaking with Israelites. Here is Boaz, a man, serving a woman. All of this is shocking. But Boaz doesn't stop there either. Verse 15. As she got up to glean, Boaz gave orders to his men, "Let her gather among the sheaves and don't reprimand her. Even pull out some stalks for her from the bundles and leave them for her to pick up and don't rebuke her." Boaz orders his men to purposefully pull out stalks of grain and leave them on the ground so that Ruth can gather them. Boaz directs his workers to make sure that Ruth goes home with plenty of food. And so it continues. So Ruth gleaned in the field until evening. Then she threshed the barley she'd gathered, and it amounted to about an ephah. She carried it back to town, and her mother-in-law saw how much she had gathered. Ruth also brought out and gave her what she had left over after she had eaten enough. Ruth puts in a day of back-breaking work under the hot sun, and she brings home an ephah of barley. Scholars estimate that that's probably about 30 pounds of grain that she brought home. Now, this is evidence not just of Ruth's hard work, but also of Boaz's generosity. To put her gleanings in the proper perspective, a male worker's wages for a day's labor was somewhere between 1 to 2 pounds. So in one day, Ruth took home what the average man would take home in 2 weeks. She took home 15 times what Boaz's hired male workers took home in one day. And not only that, but she had food left over to give Naomi from lunch. And so here, Naomi's response. Her mother-in-law asked her, "Where did you glean today? Where did you work? Blessed be the man who took notice of you." And then Ruth told her mother-in-law about the one at whose place she had been working. "The name of the man I worked with today is Boaz," she said. "The Lord bless him," Naomi said to her daughter-in-law. "He has not stopped showing his kindness to the living and the dead." She added, "That man is our close relative. He is one of our guardian redeemers." Then Ruth the Moabite said, "He even said to me, 'Stay with my workers until they finish harvesting all my grain.'" Naomi is so overwhelmed that she can hardly contain her excitement. "Where in the world did you glean today? How did this even happen?" And then Ruth tells her, "I worked in Boaz's field." And now it's all coming together for Naomi. God has not forgotten her. God has not stopped showing his love to his people. And then Naomi reveals a vital piece of information to Ruth. Boaz is one of their relatives. He's one of their guardian redeemers. Now that little piece of information is important for the rest of the story, and we'll talk more about that next week. But what we need to understand is that Naomi is beginning to see that God is at work here. Picking up at 22, Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, "It will be good for you, my daughter, to go with the women who work for him, because in someone else's field, you might be harmed." So Ruth stayed close to the women of Boaz to glean until the barley and wheat harvest were finished, and she lived with her mother-in-law. And with that, we end this scene of the story. So let me share with you a truth about God and two observations about how that truth impacts the characters in the story. First, the truth about God. What we see throughout the story of Ruth is the providential love of God. Two major themes in the book of Ruth are the providence of God and the love of God, which Barry talked to us about last week. It's the Hebrew word hesed. But what exactly is the providence of God? Often we chalk things up to chance, fate, luck. But providence is the belief that there's more going on than we're aware of, because God is intimately and actively involved in sustaining and governing our world. He's at work in the shadows so that his purposes and his plans are accomplished for our lives. God has not simply set the world in motion and now he's sitting back watching us make a mess of it all. It's not how he works. You know, there's actually not a whole lot of references to God in this book. It's really just the story of ordinary people living their everyday lives. Yet we clearly see God's hand in this story. In chapter 1, we see that God stopped the famine in Israel so that Ruth and Naomi could return to Bethlehem. And not only does Ruth end up in Boaz's field, but at just the right time, Boaz shows up, he sees Ruth, and he extends her extravagant generosity and kindness. And Naomi begins to see the fingerprints of God all over her life and Ruth's life. When she comes home with a bounty of food and she discovers that Ruth has been working in Boaz's field, Boaz isn't just a stranger, he's family. Naomi begins to see a glimpse of God's hand. She has not been forgotten. God is intimately and actively involved in her life. And friends, God is intimately and actively involved in your life as well. He's working in the shadows, even when you don't see it, even when you don't feel it. He has not forgotten you. He's a promise-making, promise-keeping kind of God. This is the providence of God, and he is for you. And that leads us to the other major theme in the story of Ruth. And that's the hesed of God. The loyal, steadfast love of God. This love that will never, ever let us go. And as sons and daughters of God, we are to be people who do hesed. Here's how Carolyn Custis James puts it. Hesed is a strong Hebrew word that sums up the ideal lifestyle for God's people. It's the way God intended for human beings to live together from the beginning, the love your neighbor as yourself brand of living. An active, selfless, sacrificial caring for one another that goes against the grain of our fallen natures. Two parties are involved, someone in desperate need and a second person who possesses the power and resources to make a difference. Hesed is driven not by duty or legal obligation, but by a bone-deep commitment, a loyal, selfless love that motivates a person to do voluntarily what no one has the right to expect or to ask of them. They have the freedom to act or to walk away without the slightest injury to their reputation. Yet, they willingly pour themselves out for the good of someone else. It's actually the kind of love we find most fully expressed in Jesus. In a nutshell, hesed is the gospel lived out. This is how God loves us, and this is how he calls us to love others. Hesed is something you do. It's the core of who we are as followers of Jesus. And while the word hesed actually only shows up three times in this story, it's seen on every page of this book. Put these two themes together, and you have the providential love of God. So let me share with you two observations about how the providential love of God impacts the characters in this story. Here's observation one. The providential love of God moves Boaz to action. Boaz is a man of integrity and honor. He's a businessman trying to do the right thing. And so he allows for gleaners in his field. This is what God requires, and Boaz does it. But when Ruth asks to glean and gather from among the sheaves, Boaz has every right to ignore her, to disregard her request. He could have kicked her off his property. But instead, he's moved by the providential love of God to act on her behalf. He becomes her champion, and he's determined to help Ruth and Naomi. He tells her to stay in his field, to glean with his female workers. He protects her. He provides for her physical needs of food and water. He invites her to eat at his table. Boaz turns Ruth, an outsider, into an insider. He welcomes her. He even goes as far as to serve her. But he doesn't stop there. He does everything he can to ensure that Ruth will go home full and that she will have enough to feed herself and her mother-in-law. He's extravagant in his generosity when he tells his men to intentionally pull out stalks of grain so that Ruth can gather it. Boaz values Ruth as a fellow image bearer, and he doesn't allow their differences in gender, ethnicity, or social class to get in the way. He sees her the way God sees her. He sees her as a daughter of Yahweh. He treats her with dignity and respect. Boaz does hesed to Ruth. The law required one thing, but Boaz understands the spirit of the law. God's heart was to ensure that the poor and the vulnerable would be cared for, and that's exactly what he does. Boaz has power and resources, and he uses them on behalf of a desperate woman because that's how you do hesed in the kingdom of God. The providential love of God moves Boaz to action. But he's not the only one impacted by God's providential love. Observation two, the providential love of God moves Ruth to action. Ruth leaves her home, her family, everything she knows. She pledges her loyalty and love to Naomi and to God, and she, as they return to Bethlehem. And as soon as she gets there, she doesn't just sit around. In spite of the tremendous loss and tragedy she suffered, she does the next right thing. She knows she has to provide for herself and for Naomi, who's in no shape to work. So she sets out to glean, and while she's in the field, she realizes, there's no way we're going to have enough food if I just pick up these scraps. And so she understands God's heart for people, especially for the poor. And she makes a bold proposal. She risks everything by asking to go where she's not allowed to go because she had made a vow to care for Naomi, and she was determined to keep it. If she doesn't do this, they will starve. And so she ends up bringing home more than enough food. Every day she goes out into those fields. She pours herself out. She gives everything she could. Ruth is deeply committed to Naomi. And not because of what Naomi could do for her, but because that's how you do hesed in the kingdom of God. Let me share with you the story of my friend Jan and how the providential love of God moved her to action. 15 years ago, Jan started serving as a mentor to at-risk students at Sam Houston Middle School right here in Irving. She spent 30 minutes a week investing in the lives of young people. And over the last 7 years, she's been a mentor to Lolly, who she met when Lolly was in the sixth grade. Lolly had an unstable home life, struggled with school, but through all the ups and downs, Jan was a consistent, faithful presence in her life, encouraging, praying, and caring for her. Lolly wasn't sure if she'd graduate. Teachers weren't sure if she'd graduate, but she kept pressing on. And Jan promised her that if she graduated, she would throw her a party. And this past May, Lolly graduated from high school, and Jan celebrated her with that party. And over the years, Jan and Lolly have developed a close relationship, and so she goes beyond the obligations of a mentor, and she continues to be a presence in her life, walking with her through the college admissions process. Jan has had an incredible impact on Lolly's life. To love another selflessly and sacrificially, to willingly pour yourself out for the good of another by investing in the life of a student, that's how you do hesed in the kingdom of God. So what are we called to do with all of this? Well, here's the application for us. The providential love of God moves us to action. Here's the thing. The people of God can't just talk the talk. The people of God walk the walk. We can't just be about platitudes. We must be about action. The providential love of God moves us to action. Who is God calling you to do hesed to? And what step can you take to do that? And hesed isn't just a one-time thing. It's a deep, consistent, faithful lifestyle of willingly pouring yourself out in selfless, sacrificial love for others. And if you're not sure how to get started with that, we would love to help you. Right after this service, you go out those doors, out in Town Square, our missions team and volunteers are waiting with opportunities for you to do hesed. Maybe for you, God's calling you to do hesed by loving migrants at our border. We have upcoming service trips and various ways you can actively engage in loving them. Perhaps for you, God is calling you to do hesed by serving the homeless in our community. Do you know that there are no family shelters in Irving? So we partner with an organization called Family Promise to provide overnight stays, meals, and transportation. Maybe that's how God's calling you to do hesed. Or maybe for you, God is calling you to do hesed by becoming a mentor, by spending 30 minutes a week investing in the life of a young person. Do you know that at-risk students that have a mentor are 55% more likely to be enrolled in college than those that don't? 55% more likely. We can make a difference in the lives of students. We can and we must. We need 46 mentors for our students. And can I just be honest with you? In a church our size, I'm not sure why that should ever be a problem. We can do that. Maybe that's how God's calling you to do hesed. Or maybe for you, God's calling you to do hesed by reaching out to a neighbor or a coworker in need. See, I think when Jesus said to love your neighbor as yourself, he might have been talking about your actual neighbor. Who is God calling you to do hesed to? And what step can you take to do that? And listen to me, I'm not trying to tell you it's easy. I think often it is hard and it is uncomfortable. But here's what I do know. There is incredible joy to be had when we give our lives away for the sake of others. God is inviting us to be part of pushing back the darkness in our community, to live boldly, to do the next right thing by doing hesed, not as an obligation or something to check off our list, but as a way of life. Church, this is who we're supposed to be. Hesed is who we are. Hesed is what we do because hesed has been done to us. And the greatest display of hesed was seen in Jesus Christ. The providential love of God moved Jesus to action. Jesus laid aside his majesty and power, and he entered into our world as a frail, helpless baby. He took on skin and bones. He made himself nothing, taking on the very nature of a servant. He willingly poured himself out for our good. Jesus took our sin. He bore our shame. We were the desperate ones. We were the ones with nothing to offer in return. And God in the person of Jesus Christ gave everything he had so that we could be brought back into relationship with him again. This is Hesed. As followers of Jesus, Hesed is who we are. Hesed is what we do because Hesed has been done to us. Friends, the providential love of God must move us to action. And so we come to the table this morning to remember and to celebrate the incredible Hesed of God. If you're here this morning and you've got difficulty navigating the steps, simply slip up your hand and one of our ushers will come and serve you the elements right where you are. As you come to the front, you may want to come here and kneel and pray and perhaps light an amber candle as a symbol of a prayer that you're offering to God. Maybe the prayer that you ought to pray this morning is, God, who do you want me to do Hesed to? What step do you want me to take to do that? Maybe that's the prayer that you need to pray this morning. And maybe you're sitting here this morning and you've never actually put your trust in Jesus. Jesus, out of Hesed love for you, gave his very life. God loves you with a deep, never-ending, loyal, steadfast love, a love that will never let you go. And so if that's you this morning, if you want to put your trust in Jesus, you can talk to God right where you are. But you're also welcome to come here and to light a red candle as a symbol of your new relationship with Jesus. And as always, there will be men and women with blue candles available up front here to talk with you and to pray with you, to answer any of your questions. So on the night on which he was betrayed, Jesus took the bread, and after he had given thanks, he broke it, and he said, "This is my body. Do this in remembrance of me." And in the same way, after supper, he took the cup, and he said, "This cup is the cup of the new covenant. You now have new access to God through my blood. Drink it in remembrance of me." And Paul says that as often as we eat this bread and drink this cup, we proclaim the Lord's death. We proclaim the gospel until he comes again, and friends, he is coming again. Jesus is the host of this meal. This is his table. He invites you to come.